Hello, I'm Dr. Lucy Blue, and this is the Dive and Dig In-Depth podcast. Today, I'm taking you down deep into the world of side-scan sonars, an instrument used for detecting and imaging objects on the seabed. And there's no better person to explain how sonar works than the man who developed it, Marty Klein. 60 years ago, Marty, then an electrical engineering student, reinvestigated top-secret technology developed by the US Navy as a survey tool and began looking at other ways that it could be used. Over his career, he not only applied it to underwater exploration, locating shipwrecks, mapping the seabed, but he also used it in less conventional ways, in the search for Nessie, the monster who supposedly lives hidden in the murky depths of the Scottish lake Loch Ness. Marty featured in the first series of the Dive and Dig podcast, and now we hear his in-depth story.
Sonar was around early in the 20th century. A lot of different people were involved with it. And it was used primarily for the military. And if I'm the father of anything, it's commercial side-scan sonar. And I got into it sort of by accident, and I was at MIT, and I had to do a thesis, a senior thesis to graduate, and I like to build things. I like to put things together with my hands, and I was about to do some very theoretical thesis, and I didn't want to do that, and I found my way almost by accident to the lab of the Strobe Lab, where Professor Harold Edgerton worked, and I had heard of his reputation, although I didn't know that much about him. But I came in, and he was always hospitable, and I told him my plight and I asked if he might have anything interesting to work on. So he brought me right in, and it turns out the timing was kind of amazing. Edgerton had worked with Jacques Cousteau. Edgerton was his primary famous for the development of the strobe light back in the 1930s. And Jacques Cousteau was introduced to Edgerton by the National Geographic Society. Cousteau wanted to take cameras take pictures in the deepest part of the ocean. And so they became close friends. And Doc and his technician, Bill McRoberts, made deep water cameras that could go to any depth in the ocean. And they, in fact, went out to sea and took for the first time, photographs in the very deep ocean. And in order to position that photo device, they used a pinger, a sound device that would send out a ping once a second. And as the sonar, they had this big metal sonar rig. As it got near the ocean floor, when it got within about 10 or 20 feet, they would trigger the cameras, and that would take the photos. And the pinger, it was a converted echo sounder from the Navy that Doc had. He noticed that he was getting a little bit of penetration. He wasn't just seeing the echoes, he was seeing through the bottom sediments a little bit. And this had been done before by others, but Doc took it to a different level. He began developing a device he called a mud penetrator. He wanted to look at the sediments in the Charles River next to MIT in Cambridge and Boston and Boston Harbor. So he's working on this thing, and he asked if I could help with it, improve it, make it better. And it was a confluence of things that happened. As a young kid, I had in the 1950s, I had become fascinated with these new devices called transistors. In those days, everything worked with valves, vacuum tubes, and I had actually built little radios and all kinds of stuff as a teenager, with transistors. So I began to work to improve Doc's mud penetrator. And Doc's original device, his mud penetrator, looked straight down. But at some point in the lab, which you were seeing, it was pointed sideways. So at some point he just rotated it so it could look out to the side. And at the time, this thing was not a very high resolution. It used a low frequency and a long pulse. And but right from the start, Doc and I started looking for shipwrecks, and we were able to find some. There's a very famous one that Doc found in Buzzards Bay off the coast of Massachusetts here. It was the Vineyard Lightship. It was a lightship that had sunk. And we'd go out and found with this mud penetrator a number of ships. If the bottom was pretty featureless and the wreck was really standing out, we would often find a wreck, and we found lots of wrecks. The pictures in those days were not good, though. The records were very crude. So unless the bottom was really clean and there was nothing else around, you wouldn't see things. But we did find wrecks right at the start. There's a, if I may go on a side picture, Doc and I once went out with a captain of a ship in Boston Harbor who had, he had lost a tugboat or some kind of boat, I forget. And we went out and we ran, we were doing survey lines, and we got a big target, which looked to us like it might be a ship. So we threw a buoy, and on this particular ship, the buoy that we threw hit a gas bottle on the ship, and this gas bottle came up to the surface and started chugging around in a circle, and the gas bottle had the name of the ship on it. And it was a wonderful moment. Doc had a great sense of humor, and we would joke with each other and tease with each other. And the skipper of the ship was flabbergasted that we had done that. And Doc and I winked at each other and said, well, we usually try to hit the nameplate, but in this case, we just got the gas bottle. So we've had a lot of fun over the years with these things. The history of sonar goes back a long way. And then the history of side-scan sonar goes back to World War II. I'm still trying to trace the history. It's one of my obsessions. There was work done in Germany, in France, in the United States, in some maybe in Canada, some maybe in Japan. And it was all classified everywhere. So to this day, it's very hard to find out the detailed history of it. But I got involved in, when I was at EG&G, in working on a commercial side-scan sonar. These military things cost millions of dollars and were very complicated. I was determined to make one that really worked well, but that was affordable and that could be bought by an ordinary mortal. And so that's what I did. To go back to the beginning with sonar, the way we humans see, sense the world is primarily with our eyes, with light and optics. And it's marvelous. We have an image. In fact, it's kind of a miracle. You and I are looking at each other across the ocean. And, we take it for granted now. But light does not travel well in the water. And this has been known for a long, long time. In many places, the water is murky. Even in really good situations, it can be seen maybe 100 meters or something. But light doesn't travel well in the ocean. So people learned a long time ago that sound does travel well in the ocean. It travels for long distances. And so people have been using sound in various ways, as I say, since the early part of the 20th century. They used it to look for fish. They used it for echo sounding or hydrography to determine the depth of the bottom. After the Titanic tragedy, a lot of work was done on sonar just to look at the bottom and see if you're going to come to an iceberg or a shallow water. So the sound's been around for a long time. And so sound has been used to look for things in the ocean, to detect the ocean bottom, to look at sub-bottom layers, and a lot of military things, to look for enemy submarines, to look for enemy ships. So a lot of the developments were in the ocean. So the way sound works, it's these things that they call it an active sonar. You send out a pulse, a sound pulse, and this pulse might be of various lengths and frequencies. Sometimes it's a very high frequency, sometimes it's a very low frequency, and the distance you can see is inversely proportional to the sound frequency. So a low frequency travels a long way, a short frequency, high frequency travels a short way. This has been done for a long time, and you send out a sound and then you receive echoes, and those echoes might come from the bottom, they might come from a target on the bottom, they might come from a ship, they might come from fish, they might come from a shipwreck. And you then record the echoes in some fashion on some sort of a graphic recorder. And again, this was done long, long time ago, even back into going back to World War I. So you use sound, there's a lot of problems with using sound. The ocean is very noisy. The sound gets bounced around a lot. Light travels pretty well. Light travels from the sun to us, and it travels in a straight line, and it travels long distances. Sound gets bounced around in the ocean by a lot of things, by thermal differences, by it can be affected by noise, either ocean noise from waves or from human-created noise like from a ship's propeller. It can be created by rain, by lightning. So the ocean is full of sound, noise sound, and there are all kind of challenges. The sound also can get bent. It doesn't necessarily go a straight line. So there's a lot of challenges in making a sonar and making it work properly. In 1963, I had just started my career, and there was a terrible tragedy in the New England coast. The submarine Thresher sank, and I was just a kid, just out of school, and I got involved in the search for the Thresher. It was the first deep water search that had ever been done. And I was assigned to make a sonar for the Bathyscaphe Trieste. The Trieste had gone 7 miles down in 1960, and it was called in to do the Thresher search. And I'm condensing a story, but we made a sonar to go in the Trieste using this old technique with the sideways looking echo sounder. And it failed, actually. We didn't get, it didn't make good pictures. And the Thresher was found, but it was found with a magnetometer, with other devices. And I was very upset. I wanted to make a good sonar. So that's when I began working on an advanced side scan sonar that could really make where a shipwreck would look like a shipwreck. And I actually introduced it in 1967. I introduced it to the world, and there's a lot of ongoing stories where ships, including the Mary Rose, were found with this sonar. Back in 1970, I had a lawyer who worked with me. He was both a scientist and a patent attorney. And he was obsessed with the Loch Ness Monster. I'm not sure I ever was, but he asked me in 1970, he was going to do an expedition to Loch Ness to try to look for Nessie. And he asked me, could I bring my sonar along? So I did, in fact. And I went over the years many times to Loch Ness, and we had some success. I'm not sure there ever was a Loch Ness Monster. It's kind of a long story, but we did find some moving things. To this day, it's frustrating because people had used sonars and had seen some things in Loch Ness, and you never knew, was the sonar moving or was the target moving? So I did an experiment where I fixed the sonar on a tripod on the shore of Loch Ness, so it definitely wasn't moving. And I saw some targets going by, but this is a long, long time ago. We never were able to determine, were these just fish? Were they algae floating by? Were they logs? And it's kind of a frustrating thing. People actually don't, it's in the news all the time, but it's not like there are expeditions, scientific expeditions, going to look for a monster. We were kind of a crazy bunch of crazy guys doing this. So yes, I did a lot of work in Loch Ness. I went back many times. And over the years, in any body of water, in the sea or lake or river, there's stuff. There's things to find. There's submerged, there's shipwrecks. There's submerged cables. There's old buildings. There's interesting geology. And so anywhere you go, and Loch Ness is a big, deep lake, so there are things to find. And in fact, we did find things over the years. We found shipwrecks, some quite old. We found a variety of interesting circle formations, not quite like Stonehenge, but on that order, that could be nothing, could just be some dredged spoil, or there could be signs of ancient habitation. We also, one of our biggest finds was in 1976. When we did this work, we would work long hours. We would work 12 hours a day, and these papers would come spitting out of the machine for hours and hours and hours, and often we didn't have time to look at them. So on one of these expeditions in 1976, my colleague Charlie Finkelstein and I, we were back home looking at the records, and we saw a fuzzy picture of what looked like a twin-engine airplane. So we called our friends at Loch Ness, and they told us that a PBY, a Catalina, had gone down in the lock in World War II. So we announced that we might have found this Catalina. But I went back 2 years later with Tom Cummings and Gary Kozak, my other colleagues, and we made a much better picture of the plane. And this one of the guys with me, one of the fun things about this business, you work with every imaginable kind of person. One of the guys working with me, he was an engineer who worked with me. He looked at the picture and said, "That looks like a Wellington bomber." And I didn't know what a Wellington bomber was. I had no idea what he was talking about. But it turns out we gave the information to a university in Edinburgh, Heriot Watt University, and they came with an underwater vehicle, a remote operated vehicle, and they went. We showed them. We gave them a location, and they went down and found that there was a Wellington bomber at the bottom of Loch Ness, and I think it was 220 feet of water, fairly intact. And so this whole project happened. A Wellington, Loch Ness Wellington Association formed. I was an honorary member. I used to go to England and have dinner with them. And I actually met some of the people who flew the Wellingtons and who built this plane. The plane was called R for Robert. And eventually it was raised. It was a big project with Oceaneering. It was raised and it was brought to a place called Brooklands, a museum called Brooklands in Weybridge. It's about an hour south of London. And it's been restored. People have been working on it for a long, long time. I haven't visited for a long time. I did visit it many years ago. But a lot of it has been restored, and it's this wonderful attraction that people flock to see all the time. And so we had a lot of fun in Loch Ness. No monster yet. What I tell people, I often give talks to students, that there are things, including living things, in any body of water. Some are minuscule, tiny, some are big. And I have a lot of friends who work these days. There are expeditions in the deep ocean. Bob Ballard, for instance, has a ship called Nautilus, and the U.S. has a ship called Okeanos Explorer. And there's a number of ships like this that work in the deep ocean, and they see creatures all the time. Some of them things like giant squid, and some of them are just fanciful, unimaginable shapes and sizes. Some of them have lights on them. Some of them have multi-arm, all kind of means of propulsion. So it sort of doesn't matter if there's a Nessie. There are things to find, and I encourage people. I work a lot with students these days. I'm involved in a program called MATE, ROV, where students make underwater vehicles. And I try to encourage them to don't say it can't be done. You can do it. And the technology keeps improving. And the underwater, the sonars, the other sensors just keep getting better and more sophisticated. And things are found all the time. New shipwrecks are found all the time. But new creatures are found. So there's still plenty to find. There's a cliche about the ocean. I've heard it since the day I started, and it's been literally 60 years since I started in this field, that the ocean covers 3/4 of the Earth or whatever, plus or minus, and only a small fraction has been explored. And to this day, that cliche, whenever someone gives a talk about the ocean, the first thing they say is, the ocean covers this much and only a small fraction has been explored. So there's many, many things yet to find. And I'm an old man. I turned 80 a couple of weeks ago. I'm an old man now. But I'm still very excited about what's going to be found tomorrow. I still turn on the news and you know, there's all the other junk goes on in the news. But I still follow the field a lot, and I follow a lot of news things, and because you just never know. I have things, we talked about Doc Edgerton. He and I used to joke about Viking ships, that there's other people who sailed around the world a long time ago, the Polynesians, the Chinese, the Vikings, and one of these days in Boston Harbor, we used to joke that we're going to find a Viking ship where it's not supposed to be, and maybe off the coast of California, we're going to find a Chinese ship or something. So it's they're people sail. I feel it's easy to actually sail across an ocean. You if you don't sink and you stay alive and you have enough food. So I feel that people have, Columbus was very much a newcomer, that people have been traveling the oceans for a long time. So we are going to find ships and boats where they're not supposed to be. So I still owe my old professor Edgerton a Viking ship, and so I won't find it myself, but I'm hoping maybe my equipment will help to find it one day. Sonar can be used. First, it doesn't have to be used in water. It can be used on land. You can penetrate the ground either with radar or with sonar. There is hope that they're going to find bodies of not necessarily water but fluid on some of these planets, and there people are already talking about making remote vehicles and using them in other places. Incredible excitement. They just flew a helicopter on Mars recently. I actually feel the tools that I had to work with when I started were very rudimentary. I had individual transistors and coils and capacitors and things. Nowadays you have a computer memory, and you know, you have your iPhone in your pocket that has incredible capabilities, and so the tools that students have to work with and researchers have to work with are so advanced, things that I couldn't have dreamed of doing back then. So I'm actually always out looking for people who, you can tell I have a passion for this stuff, people who share that passion, but who are maybe high school age and college age, who are going to take that current technology and bring it to a new level. And I'm very optimistic that that's going to happen. We are, one of my various mantras, one is where I used to say our goal was to make the ocean transparent. And that's still a mantra. We're going to do that. So when you go in the water, it's going to be like the water isn't there. You can see just like you can on land. So there's great new things to come.
Wow, it's fascinating how side-scan sonar has and still is being used in such a variety of scientific applications, not only in the deep sea but also shallow waters and rivers. And besides finding ships, side-scan sonar also has geological and biological applications and, as Marty explained, was even fitted on the Mars rover. I hope you enjoyed this Dive and Dig in-depth podcast, supported by the Honor Frost Foundation, a charity that promotes maritime archaeology in the Eastern Mediterranean. If you want to learn more about the excitement of maritime archaeology, then join me, Lucy Blue, for the next episode when I speak with my colleague John Adams from the University of Southampton. We will investigate deep water archaeology and the massive advantages that have been made in technology that allow archaeologists to go deeper, stay longer, and record shipwrecks more rapidly and in more detail than ever before.